Hello, I'm John Wilson. Thanks for downloading Master Tapes from BBC Radio 4. I will cry when you go away. I will cry when you go away. Hello and welcome to Master Tapes. That's Mike Scott and Steve Wickham performing When You Go Away, a track from the 1988 Waterboys album Fisherman's Blues for our audience here at the BBC Maida Vale Studios. In the first part of this programme, Mike and Steve discussed how it took over 2 years to record and produce well over 100 tracks, which were whittled down to the dozen or so which appeared on the finished album. In the first part of this edition, we heard how, on the verge of commercial success after the single The Hole of the Moon and the album This Is the Sea, Mike Scott retreated to rural Ireland. There, in a manor house in Galway, he recorded dozens of tracks for what became Fisherman's Blues album. It sounded totally different from most of the synth pop and stadium rock that dominated the mid and late 80s. Now it's the turn of our studio audience here to ask the questions, and we'll have more live music from Mike and Steve. Before we get the questions, though, Mike, most of the people here at Maida Vale are long-time fans of yours. How much are you writing for them or with them in mind?
You've put me on a bit of a spot there.
I was waiting to see who was going to blink first with that one. Without doing them down, without being disrespectful to your audience, you are always writing for yourself, first and foremost.
I didn't say anything. No, and I didn't say that. When I was writing my book, the cardinal rule for me was to always have the reader with me. Always bring the reader with you when you're writing. And when I'm writing songs, I'm always bringing the listener with me. So the listener, my idealised version of the listener, which includes all of you, is with me every stage when I'm writing. There are other things with me as well, like the feelings that I've got about the song or what I want to say. And then there's the element of chance and inspiration that comes from somewhere unknown. But the listener's always with me, yeah.
Well, let's get those listeners' views. And our first question comes from Karen Claude, a library assistant from Hartlepool. Karen.
Hello, Mike, Steve.
Hello.
Would you say there was something in the Celtic soul that predisposes it to making music? And why do you think Celtic music resonates worldwide?
There most definitely is. It's part of our heritage and culture to express ourselves either through poetry or through song. I suppose it's a universal thing, really. You find it in many cultures, but it's certainly very strong in the British Isles.
But, Mike, you're from the west of Scotland.
I was a teenager in the west of Scotland.
Right,
I'm from Edinburgh.
I mean, what do you understand by the Celtic spirit, the Celtic soul, as Karen described it?
I never thought of myself as Celtic until I went to live in Ireland. And it was something that crept up on me from behind. I realised, well, I am Celtic. My ancestors were Gaelic speakers from the Scottish Western Isles, or they were from Ireland. And it took me a while to figure out what being Celtic meant. And to me, it was a way of looking at the world, of being in the world. It was inhabiting a particular dream space or world of the imagination. That, to me, is Celtic, and it has a particular flavour, and it lends itself beautifully to poetry and music, and not work.
Was it a mission, though, when you went to Galway and you started working with these Irish musicians, in your head, were you suddenly making Celtic music in a way that you hadn't done before?
Yeah.
Even though you knew that a lot of journalists would take issue with that because they had in mind the sort of music that Mike Scott made. And, you know, you upset a few people, didn't you?
Well, I think it's an artist's job to follow the twists and turns of the art. And I have to be quite honest, I didn't give a fig for what anybody said in that way. At that point, a lot of the music world was waiting to see what the Waterboys would do next. I took great pleasure, mischievous pleasure, in sending a real curveball and changing the game. I must say, I wasn't humble about it. I thought what the Water Boys were doing was streets ahead of all our competitors. I thought we'd discovered an older world that had something that we'd missed in our modernity and our march forward. And I wanted to bring that back.
Let's move on and let's have another question. This is from Roland Maguire, who describes himself here as just another German, Anglo-Irish reformed lawyer.
Someone has to do it. The question is, what course do you think the band would have taken had Steve had a better offer from another band and knocked you back?
Steve Wickham joined the band at the end of the This Is The Sea sessions, yeah, and then has been your sparring partner, certainly throughout the Fisherman's Blues records, and then over the next 25 years or so.
Do you know, my interests would have gone acoustic and organic anyway, but without Steve, it wouldn't have been anything like as good. But it would have gone that way. Might not have gone to Ireland, because he was the catalyst for going to Ireland. Maybe I would have gone to New York. I felt like getting out of London.
You think the music would have continued to become more and more acoustic then? And more improvised as well?
Yeah. Oh, definitely. That was where I wanted to go.
Would it have been as productive? Because in the first part of this programme, you talked about how the tape was rolling constantly and you spent day upon day just recording music and just recording everything that was made there, mm-hmm, in that room. So if you hadn't met him, if you hadn't been in that situation, do you think you would have recorded as many songs?
No.
How many songs did you record for this album? I said at the beginning of the programme.
Well, the complete box set that's coming out, there are 121.
Right. So how did you whittle that down? And why did you decide on... Well, it's hard to say how many tracks there are on the album, because the track listing on the back of the album, I think there's about 10 or 11 tracks, but then there are other ones that are,
yeah,
kind of slipped in there, aren't there? Yeah. There's about sort of 12,
there are
13 tracks.
12 or 13 tracks on it, yeah.
And how did you decide on those 12 or 13?
Desperation, really, John. By the end of the sessions, I had no clue what I was doing. I came up with a track list that, to this day, I think is a pathetic understatement of what we recorded. Even right. though I love the album. But we've made so much great music and most of it isn't on the album.
Another question. This one's from Oliver Barnett from Harefield in West London. Oliver.
Are there more verses to be added to and a bang on the ear?
That's a knowing laugh from people in the audience, because we should say a bang on the ear. This is a song that has multiple verses, which apparently documents a series of relationships.
Yeah, one verse to each old girlfriend. Yes, there were other verses, and there were also comedic verses about all the band's girlfriends. We used to do comedy versions of our own songs. If we'd been playing a song for a day and kind of getting bogged down in it, we would do a comedy version just to break the spell and change the atmosphere. For example, we were doing Strange Boat once, which was a song that was on the album that everybody knows. But we kind of got very bored playing it over and over, not getting it right. So we did a hoedown version with Scottish accents. So we would do things like that. And Bang on the Ear got that treatment too. A or G? Do you like G? Lindsay was my first love, she was in my class. I would have loved to take her out, but I was too shy to ask. The fullness of my feeling was never made clear. But I sent her my love and a bang on the ear.
What do the girlfriends think?
Well, do you know that first verse that I've just sung is about Lindsay? Mm. She was in my class at school when I was about 12, 13 years old. And I was too shy to ask her out. And then her family left town. And I always regretted that I'd never asked her out. And a couple of years ago, I found her on Friends Reunited and I sent her a message saying, do you know, after school I became a musician and I put you in a song. It's called A Bang on the Ear and you're in the first verse with my band, the Water Boys. And she wrote back and she said, oh my God, I'm a huge Water Boys fan and I have that record. I never realised it was about me.
No.
Which just goes to show she didn't take much notice of me at school.
Did she even remember you from school?
Just
about.
Yeah, she does, but just.
And what about the rest of it? Because the verses do document a series of relationships, some of them happy, yeah, some of them not so successful, yeah, some of them quite turbulent. Do you have to have those discussions with people?
No.
Do you have to say, I've written a song about you? No?
No.
Artistic
Nobody
license.
Has that right of retort.
Has anybody tried?
A song. No.
Another question. This one comes from Maeve McParland, who's a clinical scientist and a toxicologist from South East London. Maeve.
Mike, what I'd like to know, of all the musicians, alive or dead, who would you like to see coming in the door at your next recording session?
Jim Keltner, the great drummer. Amazing drummer. We've all heard him without knowing. He plays the drums on Knocking on Heaven's Door, Jealous Guy by John Lennon, Without You by Nielsen. An absolute master.
When did Keltner play with you?
86.
During this time?
When The Fisherman's Box comes out later this year, there's an hour of us playing with Keltner.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
That's about the fourth plug you've got in for that box set as well, by the way. You're doing well
with
the
box set is the real album, isn't it?
What is it like playing with your heroes? I know you met Bob Dylan once. You, in fact, you jammed with Dylan, didn't you?
Yeah.
What was that like?
Well, it was kind of weird. Bob was playing lead guitar. Would have expected he'd be singing a new song and playing acoustic and I would strum along with him and we'd be guitar buddies, but he was playing lead guitar.
And was this on a Dylan session or a Waterboy session?
It was a Dylan session produced by Dave Stewart of the Rhythmics in 1985, and Bob had heard The Hole of the Moon, and he sent an invitation circuitously to the guys who made The Hole of the Moon. I like your song, would you come and play with me in the studio? So we turned up, and we had a couple of hours playing with Bob and the band that was there. But he just played lead guitar. He never sang. He played lead guitar the whole time.
Well, that must have been disappointing, though, wasn't it?
Even in the gaps between songs, he played lead guitar.
And you can't really say, Bob, stop it, can you?
On my session, I would, but not in his.
Let's have another question now. This one is from Julian Bradley, who describes himself as a father of two in his late 40s, going on 50, but who always checks out the audience to see if there's anyone older there.
I saw the Waterboys in late 85 on the This Is The Sea tour, but when I saw you again in 86, it was like a totally different band, very loose with a different sound. Because of the massive difference, were you worried you might lose your audience?
No. No. Partly because we thought what we were doing was good, and we hoped that the majority of the audience would come along with us, and I figured the change in the music was too important not to do.
Julian, what was your reaction when you first saw the new band and heard the new direction?
I thought it was terrific, yeah.
So you were quite happy about it?
And also the set went from an hour long to like 2.5 hours, you know.
Can you still do Hole of the Moon? Can you strip it down? Does it work as a, you know, reimagined in the sort of Fisherman's Blues style?
I've never tried to do that, my God. You mean on acoustic guitar?
I'm talking about doing
tempo.
It right here, right now.
In a jig tempo.
For master tapes.
Yeah. B-flat. But in a jig tempo, I'm going to really take it in that
spirit. Sure, yeah.
I pictured a rainbow. You held it in your hands. I had flashes. But you saw the plan. I wandered out in the world for years. You just stayed in your room. I saw the crescent. You saw the hole of the moon, the hole of the moon. You were there in the turnstiles with the wind at your heels. You struck for the stars and know how it feels to reach too high, too far, too soon. You saw the hole of the moon.
A Master Tapes exclusive, The Hole of the Moon, reimagined as a
G. Raggle-taggle style.
Raggle-taggle style. Does it just immediately come back? Because I really did put you on the spot there. We hadn't even talked about that.
I have sung it recently, John.
Right, okay. And you never get bored of it, then?
Nah.
Right, next question. This one's from Kevin Monaghan, who is a librarian, another librarian from Norwich. Kevin.
I read somewhere that you rejected any number of songs for perceived musical mistakes and mishaps, and then in listening to Dylan, you realise that Dylan's songs are full of mistakes and mishaps, and it doesn't seem to bother him. Did you go back to the recordings of Fisherman's Blues with a certain amount of trepidation in terms of what you were going to find?
We were great at playing live in the studio and improvising, but what I didn't know, what I hadn't learned, was that when you make records that way, you've got to accept the mistakes. When I listen to classic Dylan records or Stones records from the 60s and 70s, I hear lots of mistakes, and it doesn't matter, and it didn't matter to me when I was 12 years old buying those records. It's the feeling that counts. And I hadn't learned that when we were making Fisherman's Blues. So there were dozens of recordings that were release quality that I nixed because perhaps I sang off key for a line, or the drummer overplayed, or we went out of time for a few seconds. And when I was working recently on The Fisherman's Box, I realised that I've learned that lesson now and I can let the stuff come out. If the feeling is good, that's what matters.
But listening to the finished album, do you hear things now that you wish you'd cleaned up or changed?
Oh, no, not on the finished album.
You wouldn't change a note on that finished record that we all heard back in 88?
I'd just make it longer.
Was there no suggestion from the record company that it could be released as a double album or even as a succession of albums? Fisherman's Blues Volume 1, Volume 2...
Well, now I have a big confession to make here, John, is that the record company didn't know how much we'd recorded. I'd been with a label for the first three records, and there had been a lot of arguments about what would go on the records. I felt that those records were, especially the first two, not what they should have been because of the arguments. And I was determined, now that I had some control over the Waterboys' career, not to let that happen again. So I never let the record company know what we'd recorded. They just weren't included.
You'd gone to Ireland. You rented a big house in the country.
Well, first, we worked in Windmill Lane for about a
year. After Windmill Lane, which is an expensive at commercial rates, you have a massive band of musicians with you. You're feeding them every
day. You're doing the sums in your head, I know.
The tape is rolling constantly, and tape is not cheap either. Whose money was it?
Well, record companies pay for recordings and then put it to the artist's account, and it gets paid back from royalties. I'm not sure if Fisherman's Blues has recouped over the years, but it certainly cost more than $1 million.
Were you aware, you know, as well as the music in your head when you're recording, could you also hear the cash tales?
No, I never thought about it at all. I'm a hippie. I never thought about it.
Next question's from Jed, who has come here today from Bristol, but he's originally from Edinburgh, it says here. He's a musician who admits to having gone through 22 guitarists and 10 bass players, but still with your original drummer, Jed.
Yeah, the question was, who was Hank?
The great Hank Williams.
The question is prompted by the song, Has Anyone Here Seen Hank?
Indeed, yeah. Well, the widows are weeping and wailing. There's an almighty run on the bank. The rose-decked coffin is ready to roll. Has anybody here seen Hank? Well, he's sure to be wearing a Stetson. He's as long and as thin as a plank. He's got a fistful of char and a gun beneath his arm. Has anybody here seen Hank? Keep it country, Steve.
So everybody knows about the influence of the Irish traditional music on Fisherman's Blues, but is it fair to say that Hank Williams was a presiding and guiding spirit for you in the recording of this record?
Really, yes. And we listened to tons of country and western in those days. And gospel music was huge for us. We would go down to, there was a record shop in Dublin, still there, called Clatter Records. It's a roots music shop. We used to go down there, me, Stephen Anson, we'd come out armed with a dozen vinyl albums each of Cajun gospel, folk, blues music, country.
And I guess you saw him also as a kindred musical spirit as well. I'm just thinking about some of those lines that you're singing. He ain't in the back of a limo, he ain't in his bed. He would have fitted in the Waterboys, do you think?
Yeah, he'd be a hard guy to manage. You know, he was just a tough character.
He used to play at the Grand Ole Opry in Nashville. Yeah. He was one of the regular performers there every week. And he used to sit on the steps outside the stage door. And when the rival songwriters and singers would come in, he would look up at them and he would say, "You can't write them like old Hank, can you?" I love that.
Let's have another question. This is from Chris Morley. Chris is a marketing manager for a national charity from Godalming in Surrey. Chris.
Mike, you've spoken about losing your way during the recording sessions. What was it that prompted the end of the album?
Time. Time was moving on. I had felt we were ahead of the cusp when we started Fisherman's Blues, and I could see music catching up. And I thought, we've got to get this out. Also, I think the record company would reasonably enough have lost their patience with me very shortly after.
Was it frustrating, though, to have to pack it up? Did you feel like you were finished?
I was so ready to be finished, John. Really wanted this burden off my shoulders.
My overwhelming memory was itching to get back on the road.
Oh, me too. We even had a song that we made up in the studio called I Miss the Road.
It was improvised, was it?
It was made up on the spot.
Was it recorded?
Yeah. It was recorded.
Right, and it's...
I don't even need to say it
you
now.
Don't, yeah. Is it October?
Yeah.
It is. How's it go? Can you remember? I bet you haven't played this then since it was recorded.
This hasn't been played since the day it was recorded.
All right.
Well, you take Steve, he'd like to leave and get back on the road. He'd like to get his fiddle out before his head explodes. He missed the road. Whoa, he loves the road. On drums, we had Pete Thomas from Elvis Costello's band, and there was a verse about him which went like this. Well, you take Pete, he's got itchy feet, playing with Costello.
But you did hit the road again, and it was a totally different band that then started hitting the live and the festival circuit as well. There's a great story in your book, In the Adventures of a Waterboy, where you're describing all being crammed into a minibus and heading down to the Glastonbury Festival. Yeah. And playing not when you arrive, not just backstage before you hit the stage, but playing in the bus all the way there.
With the doors open, so that we played all the way across from Oxford to Glastonbury with the doors open. And then when we arrived at Glastonbury, we played all the way into Glastonbury. And if you've ever driven into the Glastonbury Festival,
takes a long time.
It's slow. And so we were like this rolling festival on wheels all the way. And then we got to backstage, played in the van for another 2 or 3 hours. And then we came out and played round a bonfire. It was brilliant fun. Yeah.
You weren't worried that you're going to be all played out by the time you hit the stage then?
Nah.
There was always more music to make.
Always more.
Thank you very much indeed. That's all we've time for in this edition of Master Tapes. Thanks to our audience here at BBC Studios at Maida Vale. Thanks for all of your questions. And most of all, thanks to Mike Scott and Steve Wickham. Don't forget the Master Tapes pages on the Radio 4 website. You can download today's programme as well as the rest of the series. There's also exclusive content, including full versions of the songs played live here at Maida Vale and videos of our Master Tapes guests. And you can tweet us using the hashtag #MasterTapes. But we leave you for now with Mike Scott and Steve Wickham of the Waterboys playing us out with the title track, Fisherman's Blues. If you want to hear more material recorded at this Master Tape session, including exclusive performances, photographs and videos, go to the Master Tapes pages via the Radio 4 website.
I wish I was a fisherman, tumbling on the seas, far away from dry land and its bitter memories, casting out my sweet light.